Hello, 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 and welcome to The Loudcast. I am Kevin MacLean, spoken word artist and promoter, I guess would be who I am now, podcast presenter. I am here with my good buddy and producer, Mr. Mark Galley, and we have a very special guest who I will get to in a moment. But we're here at the Scottish Storytelling Centre this month, and so we just want to say, first and foremost, a big thank you to them for letting us come in and use the space. Those that don't know Loud Poets or what we're kind of about, we've been doing fringe runs at the Scottish Storytelling Centre. We have just completed our fifth fringe run just there in August. So we've been a long-standing relationship with the Storytelling Centre. They're good folks here. They put on good shows, including ours. We have our monthly events here as well. We're just off the back of one, actually. It was a great show. We had a bunch of people here at the Storytelling Centre. We had some great acts on. Esme Allman, Iona Lee, Jack McMillan, and Paul Case. So it was a really cool night. We have our next show at the Storytelling Centre coming up in February, which is going to be February the 15th. And that is going to be our fifth birthday show. I feel very, very old. So that's 5 years of Loud Poets running monthly events. We launched February 2014, and this is going to be a big birthday bash for us. We're going to have a really cool lineup, which I'm keeping a bit top secret at the minute. We're going to be getting names out there soon, but we want to make sure it's a special one, so we're keeping some stuff back. We're gonna have a couple big announcements at the birthday show, so if you want to be the first to hear about all that stuff, get your tickets. They're available now at the Scottish Storytelling Centre, or you can jump on any of our social media pages, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all that jazz. We are at Loud Poets. And we do have other stuff coming up outside of our monthly nights. We have well, I'm gonna be taking a blast to the past, actually, speaking of how old I feel. So when I got started in the spoken word scene, I was doing Soapbox, which was a student night running out of the Pleasance Cabaret Bar, and that's kind of where a bunch of people, my sort of peers in the scene, got started in Edinburgh, and that ran alongside Lit Sock Slams. Now, I had thought the Lit Sock Slams had died away, that they were a thing of the past, but apparently they're running, and apparently old people like me can still sign up. So I have. I'm going to be doing the Lit Sock Slam on the 23rd of this month. It might be horrific, I don't know. I'm looking forward to it, though, kind of getting back to my roots. Then on the 23rd, I'm going to be supporting Imogen Stirling, who's an absolutely tremendous poet, with her show Hypocrisy that she put on at the Scottish Poetry Library during the Fringe. She had a really successful run there. I didn't get to see the show, which is a real pity, but I'm going to get to see it on the 23rd because she has kindly booked me to be her support act along with the absolutely incredible Josephine Sillars, who I'm a huge fan of. So we're going to be at the Traverse doing that. And then the day after that, I'm shipping off with my producer, Mark, who, as well as being my producer, is also a poet and a voiceover actor and the general mistreated. We call him Charlie in a endearing, always sunny in Philadelphia kind of way. So, he'll be coming with me along with Katie Ailes, who's an incredible poet. We're heading out to Dublin to do the Scottish Government Hub's Burns Supper, which sounds fun. There's going to be food, so that's exciting for me. I had to make sure they know that Katie's a vegetarian, so, you know, she'll get something less good, which will be funny in itself. But there's going to be some cool folks there. We're looking forward to going over to Dublin. I've never been before, so if you've got any hints or tips or suggestions for what me and the poets should be getting up to while we're over in Dublin, please feel free to comment, to hit us up on Facebook, Instagram, anywhere you want to engage with us. We will get back to you. We like hearing your thoughts. On that, please make sure you subscribe to this podcast, give us a rate or a review, and let people know about it. It's the best way for us to get stuff out there. And we think the podcast has been good and is going to keep being good. We're going to kind of go for a little bit of a different format for a while, and that brings me to properly getting started. So we're going to have a different guest every month who's going to join me, and that might be a poet, it might be a comedian, might be a dancer, might be someone that doesn't directly work in art, but maybe programs artists into their venue, maybe someone that works as a critic or a funding body, anyone like that who's involved in the arts industry. I'm going to get them in, pick their brain, find out what drew them to their love of that art and what they're getting up to in the scene. So I think that's going to be loads of fun, and we're going to pose them some little tasks. We had Harry Baker and his longtime musical partner Chris in for an interview, and we did some quick fire questions with them, which was good fun. So I think we're going to keep that going with our guests. We're going to get each of them to pose two different things that we're going to get you guys to watch. So what we'll do is, we're recording this today, we'll get our guest to tell us about both their picks. We'll chat through both of them. But what we'll do is put one up, put them both up on Instagram. You can decide which one you want to hear us chat about, and that's what will come out in the podcast. But we will record both chats, and so if you want to find out a little bit about their other topic that doesn't get picked, you can jump over to the Patreon and subscribe there, along with some of the announcements that are happening at our show in February the 15th, at the Scottish Storytelling Centre. We're going to be making some changes to the way things like the website and the Patreon work, so this is a good time to get on board with that. And part of the new Patreon is going to be, some little exclusives from this podcast. But to get that stuff, we do need our guest. And this month's guest, I'm very pleased to have in. She has a BA in dance. So not a real degree, not from a real university either, but we'll get to that. She has a master's degree in English Lit, and she is currently finishing off her PhD in English Lit. And her English Lit degrees specialise in particularly Scottish and the UK spoken word scene at large. But she will be able to tell you much more about that than me. She is also a published poet. She, as part of anthology collections, she also has her own self-published pamphlet, Homing, which is incredible. You can get that on the Loud Poets Etsy site, so please go and check that out. She has won slam titles, she has curated conferences, she has interviewed every spoken word artist worth their salt in the country. She is a researcher, academic, entertainer, and all-round good person who has helped Loud Poets exist in many varied ways. So that is Katie Ailes.
Hello.
Wow, you've just blown Mark's ears out there. That's cool.
Hello.
So no, it's nice to have Katie in. Those that follow LP will know that Katie has been with us forever. She is a highlight of our Fringe show every year. She has been smashing sets up and down the country. So yeah, this is you on the Loudcast. How does it feel, Kate?
It feels pretty wonderful, I have to say. I'm very honored, despite the fact that you've already insulted my degrees. You know, it's par for the course with Kevin, guys.
I'll explain. So over here, you either go to college or you go to uni, right? That's like system. So like, there's a difference between those two things. In America, they're just the same thing, apparently. But then I'm like, why, you got two different words? So Katie went to Bates College, which I'm sure is a lovely college, but it's not quite Harvard University, is it? Is it?
Wow. Wow.
Just saying. But then you came here and you went to a real university.
Shade of it all.
I guess that's a good place to start. Is, so you're an American, yes?
I am an American, yes.
And so what brought you to Scotland in the first place? When did you first get here?
So I first came over in 2012, actually. I was on my junior year at, I was about to say university, but college, Kevin. My junior year in college.
Yep.
And I knew that I wanted to go somewhere with a strong English lit program, and basically had to decide between somewhere in England and somewhere in Scotland. And I literally, my thinking was, I think Scotland just sounds cooler than England. And so
it does.
I ended up,
it does.
Yeah. So I ended up in Edinburgh, and just
have you heard,
absolutely
have you
fell
heard
in love with it.
Lloyd Robinson's poem about how he doesn't like being English?
I have.
Anytime someone brings up like English Scottish divide, all I can ever think of is Lloyd. I don't want to be English. Yeah, it's excellent.
I'm ready to stop being English.
So you came over 2012.
So I spent 4 months here, did a bunch of courses designed for international students, so sort of introductions to Scottish lit, things like that, and learned a lot about the mythology, and then, you know, got the classics like Robert Louis Stevenson and, you know, Ian Rankin and all that, and just had a brilliant time. And it was actually the first time that I had performed my work live in a meaningful way. So I'd sort of done, like, you know, open mics at uni, but it's quite a different thing to actually go out in public and perform in front of strangers when it's not
there's
your
a
pals.
Different not to disparage like the uni scene, like I said, I got my start at Soapbox and Lit Sock Slams, and I know when you came here you started off in those same events. But there is something quite different to it. It's a very supportive community vibe to it.
Yeah.
It feels much more like this is going to sound really arsy, but a sharing
rather
than a kind of what we are more accustomed to with Loud Poets and other nights like Sonic Youth and Flint and Pitch and things like that, which is a much more curated, established...
I think that it's the difference between being still in an educational setting where the idea is that everyone's still learning and trying things out versus being in a more professional sphere.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was back at a Literature Society slam. Was the first time I ever slammed, and I managed to win one that November, and just sort of that took everything. That's when everything took off for me. So went back to the States, finished up my degree, and immediately started applying for grants to come back over here, which is how I got
because that's an interesting thing, because like I was saying to you, Laurel, as I was giving the intro there, I was saying your undergrad, your BA is in dance.
So I had a dual degree, so English and dance. Basically, the way that colleges work in the US is that, or at least the way that mine worked, is that you had to have a major and a minor. Right. And I was one of those overachievers who double majored and did a minor. So
see, this is my thing. I'm mocking Kate for going to a college rather than a university. She could say whatever she thinks about how unis or colleges work, and I'd nod and smile because I didn't go to either. So like, I don't know why that isn't the immediate response.
Because I'm nice, Kevin. Because I'm nice.
Right. I get it. That makes sense.
But yeah, so I double majored in dance and English. And That was great, and did a minor as well in education. So was playing around.
So you didn't know what you wanted to do, essentially. Is what I'm hearing.
I was about to say a gainfully employed poet. I mean, I'm currently unemployed and my funding for my degrees run out, but you know, I can still pay rent.
Yay.
For another month until I go home to live with my parents.
Yep.
That's all worked out fine.
The exciting, glamorous life of an academic, eh?
Pretty much, yeah.
So you're studying dance. I take it you're writing poetry at home, doing some little student open mics and stuff. But when you came to Scotland, what was your first... So basically what I'm saying is because you're an interesting sort of anomaly where you are American. Mm-hmm. So I guess people would often think that you would bring, for those that don't know much about poetry, there is a kind of idea that there's this established North American style.
Within spoken word. Yeah.
But you're not really an American spoken word artist. You're a Scottish spoken word artist because you didn't really start doing this. I know you wrote, and I know like some of your influences like Sylvia Plath and things like that, a much more kind of pagey literary base for what you did.
Yeah, so it's interesting for me because I think because of the accent and because I often write about my national identity, you know, people would assume that I was writing and performing in the States, especially since the spoken word scene there is very established. You know, the first poetry slam was in the States, things like that. But actually, I mean, I'd been writing poetry for the page for quite a while, and then only really discovered spoken word when I came to college by listening to Andrea Gibson, Katie Wersing. Andrea's absolutely incredible.
Me and Kate, when we were on tour with Loud Poets, we were down in Brighton, and it was the first time I'd seen Andrea Gibson live. Mm. Kate got myself and her tickets to go along. Absolutely blew me away.
Just stellar live performer.
Yeah.
And
if you get a chance to see Andrea, I know they're often like over here, so absolutely get tickets.
And I got to see them performing live at Bates, actually, which just blew my mind. Nice. That was the first time I ever saw them. But yeah, I think aside from doing a couple of student open mics, I've never performed in the States. I really learned my trade here from going to shows here and listening to Scottish and UK poets. And I feel as though my style, it's sort of hard to analyze your own work, but I feel as though my style is much more closely associated with and influenced by the UK spoken word scene than it is the American spoken word scene, which I'm really happy with. You know, I always think it's important to have local influences to, you know, as much as it's wonderful to go on YouTube and to read books by international artists and obviously broaden your horizons, I really value being part of this community here and having, you know, my peers also be influences on my work.
It's that thing. It's like if you're actively taking part in a creative scene, what you tend to get, I guess, hear most of, see most of, experience most of is peers rather than, you know, that sort of people who are more detached from that area. Like there's a reason why since Sam Small has become such a big deal in Glasgow, you've seen more people who sound like Sam.
Absolutely.
Because those are the people that are at those gigs. Those are the people who then you go, oh, I could be that. So it's their style you catch on to.
It's only natural. I mean, I'm sure that I've imitated you. I'm sure that I've imitated other folks in Love Poets and other folks
in the
scene.
There was that night you did Big Love, I suppose.
I can do Big Love. Very proud of that.
So what would you say are the big differences then between kind of America, the North American slam style, as it's that's kind of the catch-all term for it, right? And so let's be nicer. The spoken, North American spoken word style and the sort of UK spoken word style, or if you want to be more specific, Scottish.
So I think it's, again, it's interesting because for me, I've not really been to any live events in the States, apart from a couple when I've gone home for visits. And so the majority of what we see of North American spoken word is what rises to the top on YouTube.
Right.
So the stuff that goes viral. And that, to sort of do a general characterizing of it, is often political, often hyper-personal, hyper-confessional. Often there is a performance of heightened emotion. And it's often material that you would assume to be true or factual, or somehow the self of the poet is implicated in the work. And so I think that's quite a lot of the, I suppose, popularity and virality of North American poetry, in particular spoken word poetry, has been based on a sense that these are marginalized voices, often, who are being heard for the first time, or perhaps listened to for the first time. Those voices have always been there. It's now that we're just starting to tune in. There is, and I think we're going to maybe talk about my research a bit later, but there's sort of this fetishization that I see going on of marginality, by which I mean a lot of the times the material that goes viral is, to use quite a crass phrase, it's trauma porn. Folks are really interested in those narratives.
It's a term I've heard a lot.
And yeah.
I get why. Obviously, the States has a very different demographic and cultural history to the UK, and a much shallower pool of controversial history that is much closer and more present to people's understanding.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of phrasing it. Yeah.
So, like, whereas here there is that idea, I guess, of the, even in Scotland, there's still that bit of the stiff, you know, the British stiff upper lip, the kind of like deal with your stuff. Whereas, like, my difference would be I find a lot more humor in British poetry.
Definitely. Yeah.
Even poems that are maybe about an intense or traumatic or upsetting subject point or topic are still then laced with bits of humor. Like when you look at a lot of the stuff on like body issue or body image here, they're often come from a very funny place. Like we mentioned Big Love there, that's an example. Sarah Grant has a poem about her, you know, she has big boobs, and so she has this poem, but like rather than being a kind of feisty, politically based, how dare I be marginalized kind of narrative to the piece, it becomes here's how I can use the humor and expose the kind of misconceptions or whatever around that body issue.
Yeah, I do think I'm going to be misquoting him slightly, but I was talking to Dan Simpson about this, and he said something to the tune of, there's almost this allergy to effusive sincerity in the UK. We almost get turned off.
I mean, you're
going
to have to explain
off.
Each of those individual words.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the idea that, because often in the States, you'll see someone come up to the mic and they'll share a narrative which is based on purportedly personal trauma. So say it is a narrative of abuse that they received as a child. And often, although this narrative, although the poem itself, the text of the poem, is pre-written, pre-rehearsed often, perhaps even pre-choreographed, they know what they're going to do. They are not necessarily being purely emotionally vulnerable on stage. So I'm being very careful with words because this is a big crux in my research. They are still performing in a manner which makes them look quite vulnerable, quite emotionally effusive, right? And in the States, that often goes over really, really well because people value that idea of, oh, you're being honest with the audience, you're being open with us, you are sharing something that is difficult for you to share, and that has value here. And I think in the UK, and I don't want to overgeneralize because that will work at some nights for sure.
So just to try and give a kind of like synopsis version of that. Obviously, you do this every day and you're an academic, so
yes.
you're kind of
bogged
down. Yeah,
I'm couching words.
I guess
words
it's
quite
that
carefully.
Idea that maybe more in the North American scene, there is a value on the content and the openness and honesty of a poem, whereas over here, there's more value put on the structure, entertainment value, style of the poem. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's a fair boiling down. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, I can see in her face, just so you know, that she's going, absolutely not, because this is 4 years of research and you can't boil it down into a sentence, of course.
It's the nightmare of writing 100,000 words on this thing and then trying to talk about it in a way that is actually clear.
Yeah.
Which is also a skill that academics need to have, and so is something that I'm trying to work on. Yeah. But yeah, basically, I think going back to what... paraphrasing Dan Simpson. Yeah, I think if you were to do a poem in that style with that sort of like trauma porn, again, sort of idea of sharing your vulnerability and all of that, British audiences maybe aren't as receptive and are maybe a bit more closed off to that. Mm-hmm. And there's more of a sense of, okay, are you okay? The audience being worried for the performer. And I think that does happen in the States as well, but there is such a culture of that.
Rather than that group catharsis from an individual sharing,
exactly.
There is then a group concern for an individual sharing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that might just be down to differences in culture. You know, the cliche of Britishness being that, you know, you're more reserved and less willing to talk about these personal matters in such a way. And again, these are all hyper-generalizations, but... I think those are sort of the biggest major differences.
Because I think it is hard. I think we get to a place, especially just now in the spoken word scene, is we've kind of really... I know the spoken word scene has been going for a long time in the UK. There, you know, people have been working on it much longer than I have. But I feel it's hit a much more kind of like... It's not the new rock and roll, but but there is this idea of like it is ever increasingly seeping into the kind of mainstream. People know more what it is. People get the idea that there is a new type of poetry, even if they couldn't maybe quantify exactly what it is or how new it actually is. Mm. But what you end up getting this idea that like we speak a lot about what our scene is, poets in the scene of like, oh, this is that style, this is that style, whereas actually. We're kind of too small a scene to have clear, defined style. So I think often the argument comes down to what is hard to understand root points like that. Like, where is the core difference between North American style and UK style? Because I don't think it's in content. I don't, you know, it's not in the subjects we're talking about. It's not in the care or attention to craft or form. Mm-hmm. It's not in the presentation or the quality of performance, like, because those are matched across the board. We have similar cultural existence. We have, you know, similar access to technology and tools. So you're like, there must be something in the, and I think that's probably the point there, in the reception of it. And how audiences deal with it, which I think is something that people in any art form don't necessarily think about enough.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's like, who are you aiming this poem at? Because if you have a poem that is just like so sad and so traumatic and so painful, like that's fine, but you need to know who you're aiming at that. Because I've seen people do very like poems that are very traumatic about a subject that anyone affected by that subject, the poem's been so intense they've had to leave.
Yeah.
So then you're suddenly going, well, who are you doing that poem for? And I think that's something you find more in the UK scenes, a bit more selective about going, we know that. Like Kev sums it up brilliant, Kevin Gilday. I'm glad you've settled racism is bad. We weren't sure until you took to the mic. There's kind of this idea in the UK scene of like, do something interesting, stop saying the same thing.
Again, I think, because I generally agree there, I think a couple of points that I would make. One would be that when we're talking about the differences between the US and the UK scene, there is so much cross-fertilization and there is so much, I mean, another point in that Kev Gilday poem is where he talks about, you know, we all learn to slam from Americans on YouTube, which again is meant to also be a funny line, but with a kernel of truth, you know, people are watching spoken word on YouTube and learning that way. So there is a lot of cross-fertilization, but also I think there are regional differences as well. You know, what flies at a London night may bomb at a Glasgow night.
And I think that goes back to what we were saying before about actually your peers and the scene you're physically existing in are going to be your biggest influence.
Definitely.
Because I think maybe that line that Kev says about the YouTube thing might be a bit of a misnomer, because I don't necessarily think I learned to slam from Americans on YouTube. I think I learned to slam from Americans at slams I was at.
Yeah.
Because people like yourself, people like Jess Green, people like, sorry, not Jess Green, Jess Smith, people like Joe with the Glassies, Spencer Brown, Taylor Johnson, like these American poets that were studying internationally at Edinburgh brought this like wealth of slam experience and the right tactic, the funny political sad and their format that blew audiences away. So what you got then was a bunch of Scottish or English Edinburgh-based poets leaning into that style. I don't necessarily think a bunch of Edinburgh poets were watching full-length slams from previous years on YouTube. So it's like that line doesn't really land for me, because I think then what you see on the Glasgow side was people influenced by the hip-hop scene and the much more sort of working class, like, genuine Scottish voice, authentic Scottish voice to it. Because, like, I'm historically from Glasgow. I probably come from a much worse, like, sort of like poverty demographic or whatever, class demographic than a lot of poets. But I wouldn't be associated that way because I don't sound like that. And I haven't talked about those topics.
Yeah.
So there's that thing of going, like, you get subject matter, you get tone, you get style from just the scene that's around you.
Definitely. Yeah. Hi, my name is Katie Ailes, and this is a poem called This is Science. This is science. This. The heel striking ground, followed by ball, then toes. The roll of it. The Sistine Arch holding the motion. Then the release into the air, that ancient dead gas from the earth but not of it, with flickers of living things, or life-giving, who knows the difference. Then again meeting ground, that seemingly stable mass assumed intractable and finding the give of it. This, knowing your take, the place that made you, that grew you infinitesimal from cells into a pressure, extending into this space, mattering. To know without transgression, without dissection nor negation, to breathe in this ancient living gas, and to want to know the difference.
I think one of the big issues, and you're someone, this brings us on to kind of more your PhD research, which is you had a really good opportunity that a lot of Scottish poets don't get the opportunity to do, which is go around and see and hear and meet a bunch of poets not from Scotland.
Yeah.
Because while we get a lot of people up during the Fringe, and some shows up here manage to bring people in occasionally, poets from further afield, there is a thing of like, it's quite a separate little, you know, enclave up here in Scotland. There's not the same cross-pollination, cross-fertilization
for sure.
You were talking about. So, like, how did you find, kind of, you were here 4 years, 3 years, doing Scottish scene. How did you find it when you went out to kind of interview other poets? I should explain. So you're doing a PhD. Mm-hmm. That PhD, I'm going to give a little cliff note here, and we'll judge from Katie's face how accurate I am. So your PhD is on, broad stroke-wise, authenticity and its effects, the effects of its perception from an audience and from the point of view of poets knowing how audiences perceive authenticity and how that affects that relationship. She's doing a big thumbs up and a big smile. I've absolutely nailed that. So part of Kate's
research...
Can you
write my abstract?
You absolutely don't want that.
No.
So Kate, as part of her PhD, was to go out and collect data from across the UK, talk to those poets about authenticity, about how they believe themselves to be perceived on stage, about the level of honesty in their poems, whether characters are acceptable, whether you can talk about subjects you haven't actually had first-hand experience of it. It's going to be, if you're not someone who's involved in the spoken word scene, you may not get why this is very exciting for us, but it's not a field that has a huge amount of academic research done into it. A lot of that research is old, a little outdated, more skewed to an American viewpoint. And this is the first time there's been a big collection of the sort of thoughts, viewpoints, practices, ideas of spoken word artists across the UK. So when Kate eventually publishes this, hopefully there's a book, hopefully there's some sort of, you know, way we as poets can access it. I know all that information is going to be put into the National Archives and things like that. It's a real, I think anyway, a real sort of watershed kind of threshold moment for the scene. And I think the research will be incredibly important. But the big boost for it was Kate got to kind of go around and travel and speak to loads of cool poets. So tell us a bit about that. How did you find that? Did you see differences?
It's funny, you can tell how much I natter on about my research around you. That was a very good synopsis. I do my research, man.
You very much do.
It was a wonderful process. So I was lucky. I should give a couple of thanks as well. So I'm funded in my research by the University of Strathclyde, and they gave me some extra
an actual university
the
wow.
rage
wow
the rage
not Glasgow you though right
and now cut while I smack him in a pacifist manner. What I ended up doing was, over the course of about 8 months, I interviewed 70 poets from all around the UK. So, every country of the UK. I did Northern Ireland, but unfortunately not Ireland yet. That's hopefully for a next project.
Technically, but not part of the UK.
Exactly.
British exactly. Isles, right?
Yep. And so
let's not start a thing. Let's just Northern Ireland's lovely. Southern Ireland's lovely. They can be whoever they want to be.
Oh Lord. Controversy. But yeah, and so these interviews averaged an hour and a half. So I've recorded over 100 hours of raw data, which was a lot. So transcribing that has been a ball. But it was really, really great to go around and talk to folks from all over the UK. I talked to poets at the very starts of their poetic careers and folks who have been professional for decades.
Who said the weirdest stuff?
Oh, so many people. I mean, like, I'm not going to name and shame, Kev. Rob Otten was a delight. Rob Otten was a delight. One of my favorite things that I will share is I started every interview by testing out the recording equipment and asking the poet what they had for breakfast that morning. Poets are weird, especially the ones during the fringe. Those were a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So because most people did not just have toast or oatmeal or banana. My favorite one of them all was Tyrone Lewis, God bless him, who for breakfast had a bucket of cinema popcorn because he had been to the cinema that morning.
I'm also going to assume that's not the first time Tyrone has
almost
had
definitely not
popcorn cinema, nope. Cinema popcorn for breakfast.
Nope.
What a but legend.
Yeah, at some point I'm going to write a poem based on all of the breakfasts that UK poets
eat. That's an excellent idea.
I have a list somewhere on my computer. Someone had soup for breakfast. Anyway. But so the questions that I was asking them were around sort of basic things like, how did you get into this? What's the history of your local scene? So questions that aren't actually directly relevant to my thesis, or rather that I'm not going to be talking about in the thesis. I'm not writing a comprehensive history or anything like that, but that I hope will be useful for future researchers. As you mentioned, all of these interviews are being publicly archived at the Scottish Oral History Centre based in Glasgow, which I'm very excited about, because what I figured was, you know, if I'm going to be recording over 100 hours of interviews, you know, I don't want that to just be, you know, languishing somewhere on my laptop. I want that resource to be accessible to folks, particularly given the relative lack of spoken word resources out there. So yeah, so I asked questions about history and stuff like that, but I also asked a lot of questions around performative authenticity. So how poets engage with ideas of truth in their work. So whether they feel as though they're always telling the truth, whether they feel as though the audience interprets their work as truthful or honest. Again, these concepts are all super subjective. So I received a really wide range of answers there.
I guess it comes to that point of if people want to get an idea of what you mean by are poems true, are poems honest?
Yeah.
There seems to be an idea, and I know from talking to you about your research, that it's kind of confirmed by the majority of poets, not necessarily all. But there is this idea that unlike stand-up comedy or theatre or dance or even music to a degree, that the people performing aren't necessarily thought to have written that material, and that material may not be true to their life, that you can sing a sad song without the sad thing having affected you.
Yeah.
Whereas in spoken word poetry, there's an assumption that poets are being honest, that they have written their own words that are a true reflection of things that have happened to them, and that the performance of that is linked to a genuine, true emotion.
Exactly. Yeah. So that sums it up pretty much perfectly.
And there obviously there's aberrations to that. There are people who do character pieces. There are you know, people that can frame it, but it's about when you choose to frame it, how you choose for all those kind of like aspects around what the audience think is true.
Exactly. So what I'm looking at in my research is, first of all, whether, you know, how the poets think of their work in relation to the idea of truth and authenticity, but also how they consciously or subconsciously perform truth and authenticity, and how the actual events, spoken word events and conventions and the spaces that we use underline and reinforce this idea of truth telling. So, I mean, I won't go super deep into theory, but I look at how there's...
A good example is right now we're in the Scottish Storytelling Centre.
Yes.
If you do a one-hour poetry show here, it's a theatre space.
Mm-hmm.
There are your audience might be used to seeing fictitious material
exactly,
here.
Yeah.
So the idea of authenticity isn't necessarily as important.
Mm.
Where if you're going to literally a gig in someone's flat,
mm-hmm.
or a gig in like a little, you know, sort of underground club where it's all a bit ramshackle, there's an idea then that this is an underground swell, this is something organic and authentic and naturally arising rather than a curated night.
Exactly, because in those sorts of environments there are fewer physical or you know, symbolic filters between the audience and the performer. You know, it's a more natural setting. There's often less physical space between the performer and the audience.
Even to a basic thing of here at the Storytelling Centre, we have acts backstage, so they are not in the audience for the show. Whereas most poetry shows have the act sitting in with the audience.
Exactly.
And there's something that adds to the idea of, oh, they're just like me, they're saying something true, because you've seen them literally stand up out of one persona into the other, so you don't see the dividing line.
Precisely. Yeah, so elements like that, where you're seated, the costuming is often not what you would perceive as costuming. It's often day wear. And usually people are using their own names rather than stage names. Or if it is a stage name, it's something like Hannah Hutzpah or Layla Josephine.
You're not going to necessarily think.
You know, that being a bit of a shift from the ranting poets where you had, you know, Selena Godden was Selena Saliva and, you know, Attila the Stockbroker and that sort of era. We've gone very much back into using as much as possible a seemingly natural and non-theatrical persona.
I thought it was quite interesting. I didn't get a chance to speak to you about it, but we had an act at the Last Loud Poet Show who we have booked before, and we have booked them under the name Captain of the Rant. And he made a decision this time to be Paul Case, which is his name. And I didn't get a chance to speak to him about it either, of why he made that decision. Is that something he uses both of them? Because it is an interesting thing. You did used to have that crop of people who were Porky the Poet, and you know, like it was the idea you had a kind of the ranters, like
An exaggerated persona. And I think that does pretty significantly influence the way in which the audience perceives the work.
I know as a promoter, I would rather put a real name on a poster than... I was pleased when he messaged me saying, can you put me down as Paul Case rather than Captain of the Rant, because I was like, because the audience you're projecting to, if that's the accepted, whether it's right or wrong or good or bad or however it affects, if that's the accepted, then you stand out as a real anomaly when it's wrong. So that one's not real, that
and
one's
it,
a character.
It gets into as well what spoken word audiences are valuing these days, which is, and again I use this word to death, but authenticity and this idea that I want to see real people sharing real stories And that doesn't have to mean that they're not in poem form, obviously, that they're not good, that there's not beautiful use of language. But I do think that, you know, having analyzed a bunch of YouTube comments and marketing material and having talked to poets about what they think their audiences are appreciating and perceiving, there does seem to be this trend of appreciating the sense of realness and truthfulness and honesty and authenticity. And to just get into one more aspect of my research, one more thing that I talk about is how the perception of authenticity can be influenced by factors totally outwith the poet's control or the poet's intent, and specifically looking at race and class and gender, and sort of the visible and audible markers of these things.
And I guess that comes down to if you are seen as someone in a minority, you are somehow more authentic if you're then talking about those subjects.
Exactly. Or even if you're not sometimes. So a lot of my work on this is based on the work of Susan Somers Willett, who's this brilliant North American scholar and poet. And she looks at the trend, and it's not just in spoken word, it's carried out in hip hop and in music and in the blues and, you know, in all of these other genres of the stereotype that blackness is often conflated with authenticity. And what that means in practice is that we look at, let's say, a black spoken word artist sharing a narrative, and we are more likely to go, oh, he's so real. That's so real.
Yeah. And again, you mentioned Tyrone. Tyrone's an interesting example because I've heard him talk about it a few times, of that idea of like people expecting him to have a black poem.
Yeah.
And he's like,
so not just that you are more authentic, but the expectation that you will talk about your marginality and cover that within your work.
Because, for example, Tyrone doing a poem about, you know, one of his geekdoms isn't then seen as authentic because geek culture is not represented as a black culture.
Yeah, you know, there's facet of it too.
You don't often see in, you know, geek shows and things like that, there's a real lack of sort of black representation. And so you're like, so even though he is authentically geeky and nerdy and all of that, when he performs that, people are expecting him to perform the angry black poems because that's what black poets do. And you're like, well, no, black poets are black people who have multifaceted lives.
Precisely. Like, and so that stereotype becomes a bit of a shackle because, you know, you've had folks saying, oh, well, isn't that a good thing? Because if authenticity is valued within the spoken word sphere, and if you're, say, a person of color and you are automatically perceived as more authentic, then you might be more likely to win, et cetera, et cetera. Sure, to a certain extent. And there's conversations, again, that could be had around that. But the wider problem, and sort of one of the core arguments that I'm making, is that when you look at the wider poetry sphere, often confessional and personal work, or rather work that has been perceived as personal and confessional, has been characterized as lower quality. So you see this going way, way back, the division between high art and low art. You can even see it in a lot of women's writing from the 60s, so Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, Adrienne Rich, the idea that writing about motherhood, that writing about women's life was less valuable because it was confessional rather than writing about trees or war, you know, the ancient Greeks, you know. And that carries on to today. I think a lot of folks listening to the podcast might be familiar with the PN Review article by Rebecca Watts that sort of kicked off a firestorm last January, which was about how Holly McNish's work wasn't to be called poetry because it was so confessional. Watts just assumed that it was all personal and direct and thus that there wasn't any art in it. So one of the things that I'm trying to look at is saying, okay, right, well, if, again, to use the example, if you are a black man writing work, because of stereotypes, your work is more likely to be perceived as quote unquote authentic and real and true. But you are also operating within a sphere where the idea of reality and truth and authenticity within contemporary poetry is often seen as a bad thing because those things are held separate to the concept of art, which is craft and
form,
artifice
and structure,
and form.
Yeah.
So because, I mean, it, and again, there's a whole lot of steps to this equation. And again, it's a generalization. But ultimately what that means, I believe, and I see this operating within the spoken word sphere, is that marginalized artists are just seen as of a lower quality because of stereotypical expectations that they are more authentic inherently than white artists and male artists and artists who speak
you're not
with
even a,
quote-unquote proper accents.
Beyond what you think of their art, you're not even applying the same
It's a different preset to begin
it.
With,
yeah,
regardless of what they're writing about. You know, if you're a person of color who doesn't even once mention race, this will still apply. And so it's another example of stereotypical values at work, even within this sphere, which has been heralded as super inclusive and super diverse and democratic, et cetera, et cetera. But is still deeply problematic, sort of perversely, because of the way that we associate authenticity and blackness and marginality and all of that.
It's a fascinating subject. And it's like I sort of said when we kind of kicked off this little chat, I think it is something that is absolutely essential, like needs to be done. Like the lack of kind of current, you know, effective research into this scene. I mean, I speak with it about, you know, to other promoters and stuff, people in a similar position of like, we have so many good facets to the spoken word scene in Scotland, but there are so many bits that are lacking in terms of overall organization, overall funding, overall, you know, the outreach and platforms to progress to and continue past. I know very few people who are making it as full-time poets without also being promoters, organizers, social media guru, you know, like whatever it is, or having a full-time job or a part-time job or, you know, things like that. So it's like when you start putting these things in place, these conversations can be difficult. They can require, you know, huge changes. I don't know what the effect of your research is. I mean, that research is still being done and kind of put together in its PhD form, dissertation, thesis, book. And so like what the outcome of that is, but you hope that the biggest outcome of it is people spending more time actually thinking about these practices, how we look at the art that we're putting out, how we review it, how we treat each other as artists, as people, and like how we can make sure everyone's getting a fair crack at the you know, the whip, I guess.
Like your crack at the whip.
You know, I mean, but like everyone's got a kind of like similar starting
exactly.
point.
Exactly. And I mean, that's
which is
very
something
much
the poetry scene has been very, very focused on. And you can see the benefits. I remember when I was, you know, starting off and you could hardly get women to enter slams. And that goes to weird gendered ideas of competition and confidence and things like that. But a scene that proactively did gender split lineups and, you know, making sure that spots were kept in slams for women and, you know, that kind of pressure to it has led to a real shift in the demographic of the scene at large. So I'm like, you can make those changes, but you need someone to identify the issue first. And sometimes they're not as cut and dry as, well, 50-50 lineup, right? Like,
oh, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I'm really grateful that there is a lot of work being done. I never want to put myself forward as you know, the only one fighting the good fight for spoken word to be recognized and criticized well. I'm really grateful that there's folks like David Turner doing the Lunar Poetry podcast, which has Arts Council England support, and he's doing a really great job at putting out fully free, publicly accessible interviews with spoken word artists. I think we have a bunch of crossover actually in our work, which is great. And, you know, Tyrone Lewis with his YouTube documentaries.
Process Productions.
Process Productions. Those are fantastic. Niall O'Sullivan in London is doing work in terms of, you know, spoken word theory.
Also shout out to Melissa
folks.
Ridge with Boundless
Melissa
and,
Ridge
Bear,
with Boundless and Bear
over in Ireland.
Apples and Snakes. You know, this is very much developing. And for me as a researcher, you know, it's not doing research onto contemporary spoken word in the UK is not fully unprecedented. So Helen Johnson, shout out to her. She's brilliant. Her dissertation came out in 2009 and was a sociological look at spoken word in the UK. There's not a huge amount out there. I, you know, sort of spent the first year of my PhD looking up every single book and article on spoken word that I could find and read them all pretty quickly because there is just not a huge amount out there yet. It's because it's a new art form.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, it is often considered low art. It's not funded in the same way as other art forms are. But that also, you know, as much as it was challenging because it meant that I've had to, you know, pave a new path to a certain extent, it also was a great opportunity for me to say, okay, to build the theoretical framework for my thesis, I can't just rest on the laurels that are there. I can't just use what's already been done. I had to, you know, patchwork together a theoretical foundation based on a lot of dance theory, a lot of theatrical theory. Performance studies is absolutely huge. Audience reception theory, obviously sociological theories in terms of race and gender and all of that. So, I mean, my works cited is a beautiful hodgepodge of various sources.
So, I mean, obviously people can follow what you do as a performer and as a promoter and stuff on your social medias. Mm-hmm. You know, you can search Katie Ailes, right? What's your Twitter handle?
At Katie Ailes.
Nice.
I'm very simple.
On Facebook, Katie Ailes.
Katie Ailes, Loud Poet.
Yep. Instagram.
Katie Ailes.
Good. But if they're wanting to follow more of your academic work, and, you know, I know you do blogs and things like that, where can people ask questions, keep up with what you're doing, get involved in that kind of... The bit that I don't understand, Katie, this whole bit we've chatted about, I'm still confused. Mark looks lobotomized.
He does. Yeah. I'll bake you cookies, honey. I'll be fine.
So where can they keep up with you if they want to follow the academic side?
KatieAiles.com.
Nice.
I keep it easy. I keep it easy. Yeah, I've not been blogging as much lately because, you know, chapter writing. Yeah. But I am planning on starting to do that much more. And I tweet about academic stuff sometimes. So, yeah, I always love having these conversations because, you know, PhDs are...
Lonely
ass work. It's lonely ass work. It's me sitting in a onesie, you know, on my laptop crying. So,
well, there's the magic ruined. There's the illusion destroyed.
Yeah, it's not. I think people think of PhDs as like, you know, set up in offices or coffee shops and all fancy. And for me, that's not been the reality, sadly. Mm. But
well, yeah, get on Katie's website, katieailes.com, and follow our academic stuff. I've had enough of talking about big words. We're going to move on to something else. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Cool. So it is time for a brand new section. So what we're going to be doing is... in advance of this recording, I asked Katie to pick two videos that we could put up. So that could be from YouTube, Vimeo, maybe we'll include Netflix for films and stuff, TV shows, but something that you guys can get access to and watch. What we're going to do is I've asked Kate to pick two. I'm going to throw those up on Instagram either today or tomorrow before the podcast comes out. And you guys will get to pick which one we talk about in the podcast, which one you hear. Like I said, we'll talk about both. And if you want to hear the second one, you can jump over to Patreon and get that there. So the first two picks from Katie Ailes, we have a, I guess I'm going to call it a poem, but we'll get to that, called Molly by Mark Bamuti Joseph. Mm-hmm. And we have a dance film by a ensemble called Deviate, and the piece is called Enter Achilles.
Yeah.
So whichever one of those you want to pick, well, you'll know by the time you're hearing this intro for them, we'll be chatting about those. So Kate, what are we going to chat about first?
So we're going to talk about Deviate's film dance theater piece, Enter Achilles.
Right, so where to start on this one? Deviate, this isn't poetry at all.
No.
There are not even that many words in it.
No, very few words.
It's a dance piece, yes?
Yes, I believe that they term themselves a physical theater company, physical theater and dance.
And because I've done bits of theater and a lot of and I've done a tiny bit of physical theater, and it was much more reminiscent of that to me than like, bits of it are very dancey, but a lot of it just seems to be kind of like, weird balancing, which I put down to physical theater.
Yeah. So DVA have a really interesting artistic process. They're on hold as a company just now, but they've been making work since the 80s. And what they do is, rather than having a standing company that goes around and tours and performs and is consistent in its membership, they pick a different cast for each project. And so this particular piece... was made, I believe, in 94, 95, as a stage show. 95. And then they later made a film out of it. So it's a 48-minute long film.
In my sort of research on this as well, I didn't realize it won an Emmy, the video for this, in 97 for performing arts category, which is super impressive. The thing I love about it, it's so 90s.
Oh, it's incredibly and like a bit 80s too. It's very,
yeah, there's like the late 80s, early very 90s bygone vibe to it. It's very much placed there. I guess I'll tell you what I got from it. See if I'm right. You're the dancer.
Oh, no.
You can judge my interpretation.
No right or wrong, Kev. It's art.
So it's a really nice piece of film. It's basically a bunch of guys in a bar, and it's the course of their night. It starts with a guy sleeping with having sex with a blow up doll, and it kind of ends. Spoilers, but you should have watched it beforehand. You've had ages. it ends with the blow up doll being kind of really horribly abused and killed by the other guys. And it's a real, for me, it was all about, like, I don't know whether with the lens of what's going on just now with, you know, Gillette razors and all that jazz. It felt like that. It felt like an absolute piece about toxic masculinity, about the pressures of you know, heteronormative sexuality and, and adhering to that, whether you are or not. You know, that gang pack mentality of fit in, do what needs to be done. And then there's moments where sort of the intense, you know, sort of pressure characters leave and you see moments of experimentation and freedom that are then quashed immediately on the return of your sort of main kind of focus point characters. I found it incredible, which I've never watched that long a dance show not live.
Yeah.
Because it is like 47 minutes long, I think, or something. But I was totally rapt and totally engaged the entire time. And I get that's way easier to do in like a, you know, a live setting. But I was sitting in my lap, glued to it. I couldn't look away. The guys that are in it, it's a completely male cast due to the subject matter. But the performances are all just bang on. I don't know if those guys are great dancers, because a lot of it is deliberately bad dancing, but their movement, like the physical theater aspects to it, are incredible.
Yeah, it's.
Am I right? Am I on the? Is it toxic masculinity?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, I understand dance.
One of the reasons why I picked this piece, and why I love what Deviate does is, you wouldn't necessarily think of this piece as it wouldn't come to your mind when you thought about a dance show or a dance film or a dance piece. It's set in a pub. And
you say dance film, I think like Grease or like Saturday Night
Fever. Or like I would often think of like a single camera recording of a ballet or something.
Oh, like a live
but
show.
Live, whereas this is very much, you know, there was a shot list and you know, it's very evidently very well...
it's a film adaptation. This is where Perry comes in. Perry is our cinematographer, photographer, designer, dude.
Whereas I don't know the language of film as well. But so the way, I'll sort of explain a bit of the background behind it. So Lloyd Newsome is the creative director of Deviate. And he was in the hospital with a torn Achilles, I think. And he is a gay man, and he realized that everyone who came to visit him in hospital was either a female friend or a gay male friend. None of his straight friends came to see him, and he started wondering about his relationships with them, and was thinking about homosociality and how men form bonds and how they form connections. And part of his creative process and the company's creative process is to do a lot of research on site and then as a cast. So he went to loads of straight bars and was observing how men interacted with each other, particularly physically. So how they touched one another, what they focused on, what their conversations were about.
Because I thought that was amazing. Because, because there is a real thread to it of being very wary about a homosexual, like a character who is, I guess, implied to be and is homosexual when he comes in. But what they don't do, which would be a very easy thing, I think, to rely on, would be to emphasize and highlight the isolation of those characters prior to the homosexual character entering. Yeah. Whereas they don't, because straight men are incredibly, you know, some of the butchest, straightest guys are the most touchy feel, you know, play fighting.
It's very interesting,
You know, the thing that, bizarre at school, like everyone, the thing, you couldn't turn a corridor in my school without getting hit in the dick.
Oh, God.
And you're like, there's a bunch of guys who are constantly, you know, you're gay, no you're homo. Gay, you're gay, yeah. No homo, all that stuff. But then spent all day touching each other's dicks. And it's because it's nothing to do with sexuality for them. Then it's yeah. all it's all about power yeah. and it's all about, you know, like alpha mm-hmm. male nonsense. Mm-hmm. And so you get into this, so they nailed that. I was very impressed.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I love about the company's choreography is it's, you couldn't notate the movement. You couldn't really... write a score for the movement. It's often amplified.
Left, right, turn. Yeah,
yeah, no, you cannot do that. No, it's often amplified quotidian or normal behavior. So, you know, leaning on the bar and then going too far. And they're such intelligent, beautiful bodies, you know, such well-trained dancers and actors.
Just on that, in terms of like getting real movement, one of the bits that blew me away, if you've watched it, hopefully, if you've not watched it and you're here in the chat, please do go and watch it.
Yeah,
even if you kind of like find certain bits, you don't need to watch the whole thing. There's a bit where they all kind of put jackets on, blazers, and they're kind of getting a bit rowdy.
Yeah.
And then there's this song kicks in and they're kind of like walking around the bar, that, you know, step.
It's a bit...
Step, and like one shoulder comes yep. out of the jacket followed by the next. And it's that thing of like, I'd never thought about it, but you see that look so much.
Yeah.
Have you know, it's the guy carried away, kind of jacket peeling off a little bit, and they do this kind of like shoulder
march
around.
What's the film I'm thinking about with the jets? And
West Side
the,
Story.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a bit
very
like that,
that
with the
vibe
clicking.
To it. But it felt like such a real movement. It did, you know, it's a wrestling term that I really like, which yeah. is like life turned up to 11. So like, if you want to be a good character, take who you are and turn the volume up. So Stone Cold liked beer and was a bit feisty. So yeah. he turns that up and becomes a beer swilling redneck
yep.
crazy man.
Yep.
And it's that. It's like every dance they did, every piece of movement was so rooted in a genuine movement, just turned
just
up.
Amplified. Exactly. Mm. Yeah. And I think it's interesting for me because, I realized after I sent you my suggestions that both of the pieces that I sent you are all guys. So Mark Pamuti-Joseph and Deviate, and you know, I'm hardcore feminist ales over here. But
then the subject matter.
Exactly. And I one of the reasons I find this so interesting, particularly in the age that we're in now, I don't know if the term toxic masculinity was being used back then, but it's a bang on description of yeah. what's going on in this. And Newsom is super interesting in that so much of his work has focused on gay men. So he did a piece called Dead Dreams of Monochrome Men, which is stunning and is based in gay clubs about cruising and about ultimately a serial killer who was cruising to find his victims. And that piece is absolutely incredible, but this piece has such a different tenor to it, and you can tell the research that went into it. And I'm just really interesting because a lot of the work that I do focuses on what it is to be female, what it is to be a woman in today's society. And I think a lot of the cultural movement right now, especially with the Me Too movement, is about feminism and about you know, recognizing the power of women. And I'm going to try to frame this in a way that it doesn't sound like not all men, because it's not what I'm saying at all. But I do hope that there is also a focus on how the patriarchy really hurts men as well. And you look at Deviate is, I think, Enter Achilles is, I think, a really good description of that, about how, you know, the gender stereotypes put on guys about the way in which you can touch and you know, what straight men can do, what gay men can do, how those male friendships and bonds are formed, the loneliness of men, you know, the fact that the only woman in this is a blow up sex doll, you know,
it's
fascinating.
I wanted to ask you about, because it is so male focused,
yeah.
And I felt when I started watching it, the piece at the start that includes the blow up doll,
yeah.
I took as very much of a setup of who the man was, hence why it was a doll, because she doesn't actually matter. It's her connection, how he uses her, that defines who he is as a character, and that's who we're following.
Yeah,
but by the time you get to the end and the doll's brought back as an almost revenge moment, that character. One of the other characters kind of weakens his anti sort of gay stance and starts having fun and dancing around and playing along with the gay character. And he is beaten up, essentially. He then goes, finds the blow up doll and kind of exposes the main guy's relationship with the doll.
Yeah.
At which point it gets really intense, and I would go the doll becomes a character.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought was the most interesting choice in all of that is one of the most vicious and horrible attacks on that doll comes from the gay character who is attacked and beaten up the entire time. Yeah. There's a thing I was recently reading about, a poet had put up about the term fishy as like a drag term, meaning like passing, like could be femme, you know, like be a woman. Or, I hate all that. I'm going to say something dumb because of the terminology. But like would pass
fishy,
as
effeminate.
Female. Yeah, effeminate. Yeah, yeah, whatever the categorization is. And that's disrespectful to women. Mm. And that there's a little gap between two communities that you would think would be in solidarity with each other. Actually, there is this idea that gay men can be cruel and to gain acceptance to the white guys, they will ignore their homosexuality and attack someone's femininity to hide their own thing. And I thought that was, they don't dwell on it, but it was a really interesting choice in the
and
piece.
I think important because Deviate, you know, with their history of talking about gay men and all of that, they very easily, and the fact that that cast, even though we tried to get a bunch of straight men in it, it's 5 gay men and 3 straight men in the cast.
Right.
I think they very easily could have made a simple piece where the moral was, look at how messed up straight men are. They can't touch each other. They can't form relationships. They're also lonely and violent and don't know how to get along with women. Look at this gay guy. He's being persecuted, but he's a wonderful dude who's just being victimized. They didn't make that piece. The gay man has beautiful moments where he influences other characters, but he also assaults a man under a bridge and then later assaults the sex doll. And so what they have made is a complicated piece of art which doesn't lend to any easy conclusions. Those men are not purely good or evil. It's also not, I mean, there's one character that is very clearly meant to signify being gay, but it's not clear about the other men.
There's another character that I think is I think it hints at him being closeted.
Yes,
you bring up the attack under the bridge. I thought that was
horrifying for one.
Yeah, horrifying.
It is a piece of art that I should say, if you've not seen it yet, definitely watch it. But pretty healthy content warning there for sexual assault and violence. Yeah.
But I think it's kind of going to what you've said about dance and movement in general, about like being able to use that in its own sort of like metaphorical context.
For sure.
Of like, so, you know, the way you use a metaphor in language to describe something better by using a different example, essentially.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And in this case, the way he assaults the guy is by putting shaving cream on his chest and stuff and shaving him.
Yeah.
So it's like, and that idea of what it then is to be feminine and stuff. Like, so all these ideas, and consider that this was made initially in, what, like 95.
Yeah.
It's insane that like we are still 13 years on talking about the same issues, you know, like
23 years on.
Oh God. Yeah, I gave myself an age reduction there. But we're still talking about those same issues. Yeah. There's still that idea of toxic masculinity. There's still that idea
we still just went nuts over a shaving advert. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was that when it hit that point, I was just like, oh my God, the same topic. It's an incredibly powerful piece that is hilarious at points. Absolutely traumatic at points, surreal and abstract, rooted in reality. It's really impressive. I'm like ever increasingly getting dance. and like I've seen, you know, I checked out some other little bits of Deviate and stuff.
They're wonderful.
I know they've done a lot of stuff with the like different like physical ability ranges as well.
Yep.
Which is a huge thing. I know in the spoken word scene, there's a lot of talk about now about accessible venues and encouraging, you know, disabled poets to be able to get in. How do you find that in dance with your background?
It's a really interesting question because my experience in dance spans different art forms. So ballet, without badly quoting myself, it's all about the lines. In ballet, there is a specific archetypal ideal body form, which is quite thin, muscular, but all very lean muscle and generally curveless because of the idea of these perfect lines that the human body makes. This is something that I found really challenging when I was younger because I did not have a body like that at the time, and I was also a bit too tall. And so, yeah, for ballet, I mean, you... I can say without much doubt that, I mean, you could not have a physical disability in terms of, you know, missing the lower half of a leg or an arm or whatever and be in a classical ballet company. You could find other dance work, definitely, mm-hmm. but not in classical ballet because that is all about a very, very specific body type. And I don't necessarily see that changing. I do see a lot of other companies coming up that are more inclusive and accepting. And I think that's really important. I also think it's really important that while these companies are being more inclusive, that there are wider conversations around their audience base, around their marketing, to make sure it's not fetishizing these disabilities, or that it's not seen as inspiration porn. And you know, for me as an able-bodied person, I'm not the best equipped to talk mm-hmm. about that, or mm-hmm. how to identify it, or how to combat it. But I do think that the dance world is changing in that, you know, when you're growing up, whatever body shape you have, as long as you can find an accepting community and a good art form, you can make it. I mean, ballet is very far behind. Like the fact that Misty Copeland of the American Ballet Theatre, I think she was the first ever African-American female soloist, and that was like a couple of years ago.
Wow,
an
yeah.
incredible dancer, but has a more muscular form than often what you see with other dancers. She is not this, you know, petite spindly ballerina. She is a powerhouse, but has faced a lot of resistance because of that. And yeah, ballet is pretty far behind still.
I guess it's like anything. Like, you know, you get an idea of a scene, and that might not be maybe something you initially like, or you might be really into it. But it's only once you start getting into a scene and finding other versions of it, other styles, that you really start to find where your interest in a scene lies.
Exactly.
So, like, I guess the thing would be check out DV8, because that might be a nicer starting point for folks.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for folks who are worried about, okay, how do I get into contemporary dance? Because I get confused. I don't know if I understand it. DV8 is great because the work that they do is generally narrative. There's a storyline to follow. And so you won't be watching an hour and a half of people in non-signifying costumes moving around a stage doing abstract movements that don't easily lend themselves to narratives, if that makes sense. There's something to cling on to.
Sweet.
Yeah.
So, Kate, thank you for coming in and chatting to us.
You're very welcome.
You have one last task.
Ooh.
We kicked this off with Harry and Chris when we had them in. We are going to be giving you some quick fire questions.
I am so excited about this.
I thought this would be the bit you're most excited for. So my lovely producer, Mark, is going to whack 3 minutes on the clock for us. And then I am going to get started with the questions. So your aim here, Katie,
mm-hmm.
quick.
I mean, I am writing like 100,000 word PhD.
This is the thing with academics.
Oh no.
Brevity, not their strength.
No.
Okay, Katie Ailes, are you ready?
I am ready.
What Hogwarts house are you in?
Hufflepuff.
Ugh. What is your current favorite book?
The Hobbit.
Best gig ever?
Oh, the rap battle where we won.
That was excellent.
There were 250 people in the audience.
Can you believe you've won a rap battle?
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Rolling Stones or the Beatles?
Beatles.
Is there an American version there we can chuck in? Rolling Stones or...
You're bad at the quickfire thing.
Oh, sorry. Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
Favorite film?
Lord of the Rings.
Favorite TV show?
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. I was going to say Now Who's Bad at the Quickfire, but you nailed it. Okay, you give everyone else a hard time. What's your favorite breakfast?
Just a full Scottish breakfast, vegetarian.
So not a full Scottish breakfast then?
But the vegetarian version.
So not a
Ask
full Scottish...
Ask me another question, you bastard.
What was your first gig?
Soapbox.
What year?
2012.
Well, biggest audience you've performed to?
Probably 300 people, maybe more.
Where was that?
Too old, 250, that rap battle.
Oh, most famous person you've ever met?
Obama.
You met Obama?
We shook hands twice.
Wow. It's a shame we don't have time for that story. What superpower would you pick?
Flying.
Meeting Obama, apparently. Flying.
Yeah.
Cool. If you could have your work translated into any other language, what language would it be? If you say Elvish, so help me God.
Arabic.
Arabic. Hmm. Nice. What's your karaoke song?
Oh, the Sweet Home Alabama.
What's your dream venue to gig in?
Oh, I've already done a lot of them, haven't I?
Oh, isn't your life wonderful?
The Kimmel Center.
Where's that?
Philly.
Philly fans are brutal. Person you'd most want in your audience?
My mum.
Ridiculous. Favorite wrestler?
Big Show.
What's your guilty pleasure TV show?
Love Island.
Oh, previously. What's the drunkest you've ever been?
Oh, there was couscous in Mark's bathtub.
Oh,
New
God.
Year's a couple of years ago.
Poor Mark. Weirdest place you've woken up?
Like my bed. I'm pretty vanilla.
For shame. Do you watch sports?
Yes.
What's your Achilles heel?
What does that mean? Like what would kill me? Like what's my weakness?
Yeah. We've run out of time, so answer this one.
Like I spend all my time making food rather than working.
Food is your Achilles
food.
Heel. That is Katie's quickfire questions.
You're really bad at the quickfire part.
I will not. Let's not get into a thing.
So Mr. That... Follow Up.
So thank you very much for coming in to chat to us, Kate.
You're very, very welcome.
We hope it was fun for you.
It was a joy.
We hope all you guys listening like the new format of the Loudcast. We're going to be having a variety of different guests in.
Ooh.
Let us know what you think of the format. Let us know if you've got any recommendations for guests we can have in. If you want to find out more about Katie Ailes, and why wouldn't you, you can check her out at Katie Ailes on most of the social medias, or you can check her out at katieailes.com. Which is her WordPress with her blog and stuff. Inundate her with messages about when she met Obama. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Kate, have you got any gigs coming up that you want to plug?
No, because I'm going to America.
Ah, yeah. Kate's moving away. We're all very sad.
It's very tragic. I'll be going to Dublin with you and Mark. I'm very excited about that. But then, I'm on hiatus. I'm moving back in with my parents to finish this thesis and write a new visa application. And then I will be back in Scotland in the summer.
Sweet. So send Katie messages about Obama and coming back to Scotland.
Yes, please.
If you want to check out more of Loud Poets, we have our next show on the 15th of February at the Scottish Storytelling Centre. It is going to be our fifth birthday show. So please come along, celebrate with us. We are going to get... so drunk. It's going to be loads of fun. Come and check that out. Also, we are kicking off a whole new program of events at Bruhemia in Edinburgh. We are going to be running a weekly event every Tuesday from the 5th of February for 13 weeks. If you're interested in performing at these events, you can sign up. Drop us an email at iamloud@loudpoets.com, or you can jump onto our Facebook page at Loud Poets and send us a wee message there. You can hit us up on Twitter at Loud Poets, even on Instagram.
Ooh.
At Loud Poets. So please check all of that out. Share this, like it, give us a review, let people know about it. Check out more awesome poetry. Check out the Poetry and Spoken Words Scotland page on Facebook for all the details of events going on throughout the country. And we shall see you next month.
Goodbye.